This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
As our Irish cousins would say, it's a fine, soft day here at Caithness. I'm Mark Stephen, and this is Ewan McElriff.
Yeah, he's chucking it down, but we are in one of the most exciting locations, I think, in Scotland. It's a hidden gem. It's the start of our second odyssey round the North Coast 500 in our little electric car. We haven't got a name for it yet, but we will.
We actually finished the sort of first part of our journey at Dunnet Head, which we can see across the water at the moment. We've come across to Castle Hill Bay, the harbour, and it's beautiful. I mean, one of the distinguishing features of Caithness is the Caithness slab. You see it being used for all sorts of things. I mean, not just building, but, you know, the harbour here, some of it is vertical, some of it is horizontal. It fits together like jigsaw. It's beautiful. You see Caithness slab on the roof of stuff. They use it as fencing, all sorts of things.
But it also travelled the world. Now, I came here many years ago, and this harbour, we'll put some photographs up on Facebook, it is stunning, it's unique, it's perfectly preserved, but it's of global significance. It's not the greatest of weather, but I think we've got somebody hopefully sheltering that can tell us more.
Yeah, rather than holler outside and drown her, this is Muriel Murray from the Castle Hill Heritage Centre. Tell us why. Why is this area significant?
Well, this harbour was built specially, not as a fishing harbour at all, but to export the flagstones, which were...
That bit of thunder, that lightning.
You mentioned
just
the fact it was heavy rain.
Yeah, and here it is.
Which were quarried nearby. And at first, the flagstones were used locally. And then, being an astute businessman, James Traill, the estate owner, saw that there was profit to be made in exporting them. So, first of all, they went round the coast of Britain. And then it became quite an extensive export business. And eventually, Caithness flagstone found its way all over the world. The critical thing, of course, was it coincided with the advent of railways. And where there was a railhead, you had to flag or pave the alighting area for people getting off the train. And since great numbers of people went to all these towns to visit, the towns were required to pave their own streets to make it more comfortable for people walking on. And that, of course, meant that the flagstone industry was quite a profitable one.
Was it a marketing thing, or is Caithness stone, which gone around the world, was it really that good for pavements?
Absolutely without comparison. Yes, there's a wonderful story about the export to Australia, which went on for some time. And, of course, all the early settlers in Australia, most of them came from here, so they knew of the reputation of their local stone. And that was the natural stone that they sent for to pave their new towns. Then people began to say, in this wonderful big country of ours, surely we've got our own stone. We don't have to take it from the other end of the world. So they opened up quarries and stopped importing from Caithness. It didn't last very long, and then the export started again from Caithness because it was the best stone.
But you see it, I mean, the building we're standing in at the moment, and I don't know what this was, but it's magnificent. It's got a sort of vaulted ceiling, and then all the walls, you can get the right thicknesses of stone to actually make everything level off naturally. You see it as being used as slating, but an incredibly heavy slating. I mean, your slates that are perhaps an inch and a half thick sometimes.
different beds would be exposed at different quarries. And you, as a buyer, would go to a quarry and specify which depth of stone you wanted, whether it was about a 3-foot chunk or whether you wanted something very small, very thin for slating roofs.
Yeah. You must have made a real packet because it's a massive big wall around the garden. You've got this huge manor house. And I keep coming back to this harbour.
It's a thing of beauty. It really is.
It's terrific.
And it was specially designed by James Bremner. Well, he worked out of Wick, but he was born in Keith.
I was out running this morning, and I passed an obelisk in the memory of James Bremner, etc., CE, civil engineer, and I thought, I'd never heard of
him.
Because
you came at breakfast and said, who was Bremner?
Well, that's him. He was a harbour specialist. He designed the harbour. You can see that it's done in an odd way because we've got the sheets or the flagstone on their end with a narrow end facing out to the sea. Uh-huh. And this had the effect of when large storm waves came, they could trickle down the spaces in between and they didn't lift as many other harbours did.
It says on the obelisk that he saved hundreds of lives, that he rescued umpteen ships.
He was a salvager, yes, yes. He's a very famous engineer,
When I came here 10, 12 years ago, it was all in decay. I mean, there's still a massive amount of decay. But you've got the Trust now, or the Heritage Centre. Mm-hmm. What was the idea behind that? What were you trying to do?
Initially, it was set up to be an interpretive centre exclusively for flagstones. And when we took it over as a society, we realised that this was rather limited. It was a very important aspect of the history of the area, but it was a bit exclusive, so we opened it up to the entire history. So we do things to do with archaeology going way back to Bronze Age and prior to that.
I saw the Bronze Age tools. You've got cannonballs, you've got a hurricane engine, a Merlin 20.
Yes, the whole
not that
gamut.
I'm interested in these things, you understand, you know. But
we're doing the North Coast 500. This is our second programme in it. We're starting here and heading west. Are you seeing more people coming in? Do you get any spin-off from that? Or is it the kind of thing, if you're driving a Porsche, a Ferrari or a motorbike, flagstones don't do it for you?
Let me tell you that we've had no Ferraris. We've had no Ferraris, no Lamborghinis and so on parked outside. But we have had people who have based their holiday on the route of the North Coast 500. But yes, we have had one or two people who look in the door and say, sorry, we're doing the North Coast 500. We haven't got time to stop.
Which is a real shame.
Which is a real shame. So the big thing is to try and detain people in each of these interesting places as they go along.
You can obviously see advantages in the North Coast 500, bringing new traffic in, etc. But does everybody in the area like it?
I don't think there's anybody who has any aversion to it here. I can see that further over in the very narrow roads in the West Coast, it could be a little bit of a mixed blessing. But no, I think it's all positive in this area.
So you need a more discerning North Coast 500. It's not
just a bit more time.
It's not just about the twisty roads, it's actually adding value. I think there's two types of people that do this route.
Yeah, petrol heads and people who want to learn.
That's very true.
Muriel Murray from the Castle Hill Heritage Centre there. And the rain's gone off and we've driven round through Thurso and into Scrabster Harbour looking for the charging point.
Because we've got an electric car with a...
Which we're running out of fuel.
A range of about 120 miles. We've got a fair way to go. It was a wee bit of a scary moment. We came into Thurso and we couldn't find anything. We've gone past it.
No, we've gone past it now.
Hang on a minute, is that actually a charging point showing? Oh no, no, look. The charging point's away across there.
That's the ferry sign. We've just gone past the ferry sign, so we need to go right to the end here and off to the right.
And how'd you get in here at night? Because it's all padlocked.
I don't know.
I'm not sure about this.
It
feels like we're trespassing.
Well, it does a bit. Okay, well, there's no charging point.
Well,
we can't see a charging point unless we stop and ask somebody.
There's nobody here. Ferry's gone. It's a desert.
Yeah. So go out here and turn right.
We do have the option of just knocking on somebody's door and see.
Yeah, but
it's
hours and hours and hours of a wait.
Yeah, it's an enforced stay.
Yeah, quite.
It's not a deal, is it?
Is that a charging point? Hang on a minute.
Well, there's a wee...
There's something. It looks like a cabinet. What does it say? Scrubs. Hey, electric vehicle charging station.
Because...
They put a door on it. That's what confused us.
This is a wee box that looks like a loo.
Right, go back a bit because the charging point is on your side. Actually, what you should do is turn around and reverse into it.
Not into it.
Well, not into it, you know, no. I know that was a dangerous thing to say to you, but...
Well, the way you this
one. Fire this up again. Alex says, the door is not locked, says the sign. The door handle is stiff. Please use appropriate force to open door.
I'm not letting you do this because I've seen you use appropriate force before.
There you go. Right, that'll do. There will be a short intermission while we charge the vehicle and then head off to Betty Hill. That has to be one of the few landmarks in the North 500 that absolutely everybody is going to recognise.
Well, I was looking at it just now, and I expected it to be bigger. Because I've driven past Torness, the power station East Lothian, and it is a big, massive structure. You look at it, it's just very flat.
Yeah. No, I mean, there used to be much bigger buildings there, but most of them are gone, but you've still got... Everybody says, oh, the great white dome, you know, that great white ball at Doon Rae. It's not white. It's pale blue and rusty around the back there.
Yeah, and it's not very big either.
No, it's not huge. It's not huge, but... As I say, just about everybody would recognise that.
Again, we've come off the North Coast 500 and are sitting in the conservatory of Jim Johnson and Betty Hill. You're a Shetlander. How did you come here?
Well, I would never have heard of Betty Hill, possibly, except that I happened to meet a girl in Aberdeen when I went there for university. I think I met her about my third week there. Her name was Jenny Mackay, and she comes from Tyne of Braddon, which is a little house overlooking the River Naver, just at the bridge. And I came here for the first time in 1970, drove up over all that distance, 200 and odd miles from Aberdeen, arriving at quite late at night, and I couldn't believe the distance we were going along through all this amazing expanse of land, and eventually we arrived. Then I got up in the morning and went out into the porch and I look around and I'm looking up and down this wonderful river, and it was like being sort of plunged into the pages of a geomorphology book, because, you know, out at the river mouth you could see river, great river terraces, and they ran up right up the valley as far as you could see. It's a big U-shaped valley, a beautiful glaciated remnant, and it just kind of captivated me immediately. That was before I saw the beaches. The beaches are absolutely wonderful. We have Far Beach, which incidentally is allegedly one of Joanna Lumley's favourites.
Really? Okay.
And also...
I may start hanging around then in that case.
And also Torresdale Beach on the other side, which is much larger, rather more difficult to access, but equally rewarding if you get there.
You're close to history here. You're always close to geology here, but you're close... to nature, you know, you're kind of tripping over it all the time. This is, I don't know if this is cryptozoology or what, but the black cat of Betty Hill.
The black cat of Betty Hill. Well, that goes back a long way. When I came here first, there wasn't any word of it at all, but a few years later, in about 1976, then people began reporting incidents of their sheep being... killed and eaten more or less overnight. And a distinctive pattern of killing was carried out by the then animal. And it acquired the title of the Skerra beast because Skerra was one of the places where it was most commonly seen.
When you talk about distinctive pattern of killing, what do you mean?
Well, when you would find the remains of your animal, then the skin of the beast had been cleanly removed and cleaned of fat and gristle and everything. You could almost think that a human being had flayed the sheep. Also, the big bones, some of them were, whatever did it, had a powerful bite because the big bones were often broken and disrupted. And also because of the speed with which these animals were consumed.
Something very similar happened down in the Central Belt nearly 20 years ago. Yeah. And just out of curiosity, because I got photographs of some of the evidence, and I took them to the curator of big cats at Edinburgh Zoo at the time, and I said, what do you think? Could this be a big cat? And he looked at them and he said, yes, without a doubt. So there's a big cat with a transit van in the run-up to Christmas. But what you're describing sounds different.
I researched that at the time. It was just when I started writing for the Northern Times and the John O'Groat Journal. And I started writing articles about the scarab beast and researching it, indeed, over a whole area of the Highlands. Because there were other areas where that kind of thing also happened, like at Llanbraid in Moray. And eventually, puma was actually captured in the wild in that area and ended its days in the Kincraig Wildlife Park.
That I didn't know.
Aye, that's right, yeah. And also a lynx was found in a fox snare down in that area. But here, lots of people saw it, including people known to me, my own mother-in-law and father-in-law had a really, really good sighting just at the place I was describing earlier from their house one morning.
What do you think it was?
Well, I think that on that occasion there was very strong evidence that it was a cat-like creature, possibly a puma or maybe a powerful lynx or something like that.
So possibly an exotic pet that had been released, something like that.
Well,
it's a long way to walk otherwise.
Yeah. Before the scarab beast actually started eating things here, some of the roadmen were working over in Skara and they saw a big estate car with a very powerful cage in the back. And, you know, being curious guys, they were looking in about this car that was standing in an unusual place. There was nothing in the cage. And eventually a guy came and got in and drove off with the empty cage. And they kind of put two and two together on that one, you know. So it was about the time that the new Wildlife Act came out, because there used to be people in London with lions in their back gardens.
That's right. Yeah.
And a lot of people with exotic pets, and that tightening up of the law increased the price of owning a thing like that. So I think there was good cause to believe that it may well have been a cat. And this more recent one, there's been one going on here, again, just the last 2 years, which again demonstrates some of the features of the original one.
There's no guarantee that if you do come to Beta Hill, you're going to see the black cat, but it's on the North Coast 500. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed a real difference in the footfall, the traffic it's going through? Has it had an economic impact on the village?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a definite, you definitely notice a difference on the activity on the roads. In particular with high-powered cars, that sort of thing going through. And although that was happening before the NC500 was actually introduced, large groups of motorcyclists going through as well. But what we noticed in Betty Hill here is that the Betty Hill Hotel appears to be full every night in the season. And that just hasn't happened for a long, long time.
So you see it as a good thing?
Well, it's not wholly good, because, for example, there's a guy somewhere down around Nairn or Inverness who hires out fancy cars to people to go around the thing with, Ferraris and stuff like that. And so you may come in behind a Ferrari, being driven by a person who's never driven a Ferrari before, and they're terrified of knocking the sump out of it on these badly rutted and potholed roads. So they're going about 5 miles an hour. And you want to get to where you want to get to. And, you know, you're being held up by a supercar. And then you get other people coming round it hell for leather. And I believe that if you look on the internet, you'll see people posting that they've done the NC500 in X hours. Can you do it? Can you beat that?
Jim Johnson and Betty Hill, fascinating stuff, but you know, you think, could a big cat actually live out in this type of terrain?
Well,
because you need more than one, obviously. You need a colony of them.
Well, but one could survive. They're quite long-lived beasts.
Yeah, I suppose.
It's such a widespread tale in Scotland. You just wonder if there's any... Certainly, I know in my neck of the woods in Aberdeenshire, many people who would never tell the press.
No.
Yeah, I've seen one.
No, well, I've spoken to quite a few folk too that, you know, absolutely did not want to go on record. But I also spoke to a big cat expert at one stage, and I said, yeah, could it happen? Could it be? And he says, well, in South Africa, they suddenly became aware of the fact that the number of leopards was crashing on the veld. Says, you know, they were just disappearing. Nobody knew where they'd gone. And they spent 2 years, made a concerted effort to see why the population had crashed. The population hadn't crashed. It had just shifted. The leopards had actually moved in to the outskirts and the suburbs and things. They were living underneath garages and living on cats and dogs.
Just the easy life.
The easy life. But the thing is, you are in a built-up area. You would expect to see them on a constant basis, but they're incredibly shy creatures. They'll spot us, usually, long before we've any sense that they're there. I don't know.
You question that. You look at the deer population in Scotland,
yeah.
Tens of thousands, but you very rarely see a carcass.
Yeah.
They disappear. Well, who knows? It could be many, many things. Mm-hmm. Just does add a certain romance to it in a scary kind of a way.
He's a good storyteller, Jim, anyway.
There's some aspects of having an electric car that change your lifestyle. We had a fantastic drive across today. I mean, it was painfully beautiful.
Just stunning. I mean, from there was that point where, you know, effectively it was almost as if someone had switched the cloud and the rain off and the sunshine on, and you transitioned from the east. You came around a corner, and all of a sudden, I'm on the west coast. You know, and you were seeing on the route Ben Loyal, Arkell, Foynavon, beautiful, beautiful mountains, you know, shining in the sunshine, etc., the water, the gorse, everything, wonderful.
It was like the first programme was very much about the things off the road,
yeah.
The history, the people. Suddenly, when we left Scrabster, we're on a different journey. It's about the road.
Yeah.
And we were both smiling as we came over. Mm. You crest the hill,
yeah.
And there's Betty Hill beneath you.
Yeah.
I haven't been up here for a while. I forgot how beautiful it was.
No, and all the sort of various wee beaches that you see along the way, and Loch Errable, and you keep on seeing these wee islands, you know, Rabbit Island and things, and you think, why have I forgotten about this?
And you suddenly see the point of the 500. It is fantastic.
Yeah, no, it is. There are people, this is not the height of season by any manner of means, but there are people coming in here, there are people staying in the accommodation, there's people looking for accommodation here, there's opportunities. You know, this is a chance to build the rural economy based on an idea. Somebody came up with a sign, North 500, bang, all of a sudden, you've regenerated the top half of Scotland. It's extraordinary.
I haven't smiled so much for a considerable time. We were getting a bit worried about the power in the car.
Mm-hmm.
We left Scrabster with 97 miles, which should have been heaps to get to Smoo Cave.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's because of the hills and the drop. It was going down and down and down. We got out of the car at Tongue, tried the card, wouldn't work. And it was something we had a problem with earlier on. Couldn't get the thing out out the socket. So we came down to Durness, past the hotel, which is about 3 miles up the road. It's 7:15 at night. It's going to take half an hour to charge this car.
Mm-hmm.
But what a great way to spend it.
Yeah.
They've got the birds, you've got the scenery. Mm. It almost forces you to relax a wee bit.
Yeah.
But the sense of relief came round the headland, and there's a charging point. Thank you. You were talking earlier on about how quiet the roads are.
I've changed my mind.
Suddenly the folk in the camper vans have got out of bed.
It's Monday, they've had their breakfast and they're moving. Got to stop at this one. There's a whole succession of little bays and golden beaches and things like that. This one has the advantage of actually having a car park. There's two camper vans out at the moment and a motorbike. And now, what I'm tempted to refer to as the Volkswagen. It's one of the suggestions on Facebook. I like it. I like it.
I could do better than that. Yeah. Still quite Electra or Lectra. Oops.
Right, got out of the car and... Wow. Sorry, that silence is just appreciation of an idyllic scene. How many times? We're going to get somebody writing in. You said idyllic 55 times. Between Wick and Ullapool.
Magic 42. And fabulous 37.
And I apologise to no one.
Yep.
The sun's come out. It's pretty windy.
Aye. Let's go down the steps.
We've got this really rugged hillside beside us. The gorse is in full bloom.
Well, here's a wren singing off to the right. And then what we're doing is just basically coming down across Macca. And the sand itself, it's almost got a greenish tinge. It's picking up, it's so white, the sand, it's picking up the colour of the sea. That's beautiful.
And you've got a very pinky tinge to the granite.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been bay after bay like this.
Yeah. And it's the regularity of the breakers. So you've got white line, then 50 metres back, white line, 50 metres back, white line. It's obviously very gently shelving, but lovely.
And I will make apologies for this. You'll probably hear it many, many times. You don't have to go anywhere else in the world.
It's the fact that the green comes right the way down onto the sand. And then you've got 50 metres of sand, some footsteps. It's a bit like that shot in Whiskey Galore, the original one. And then the water. Somebody must have been in swimming, I think.
Somebody's been on our beach. Wait a minute. Because we'd stick some photographs up on Facebook, but...
I've got my phone back yet. And when I do get my phone back yet, there's no guarantee the flipping thing's going
to
work.
Well, then talk to me. What happened?
When we stopped at the Kyla Tongue, I left my phone on the roof of the car. And I thought to myself at the time, I must remember to take that off. And then I was going to make a phone call and I thought, oh, wait a minute, where's the phone? And immediately I knew what had happened.
To be perfectly honest, there was no way we were going back.
No.
Because we didn't have enough charge.
Well, that's true. There is also that.
It adds a whole dimension to your journey because you've only got 30 miles left in the tank to get to the next charging point.
Yeah.
Unless we start knocking on doors and say, can we borrow your shaver plug?
Well, that was the next step. But as it turns out, somebody's found it. The screen is smashed and we're hopeful I should be able to retrieve some of the information off it that I put on it yesterday. Photographs, videos, that kind of stuff.
This is quite intriguing because the footsteps go to the edge of the water and then they disappear.
Yeah. Somebody went in. One of those camper vans back there actually had a towel hanging on the outside, so I think somebody's been swimming.
We have this beach to ourselves, and such is the joy of radio, and you're not on this beach. Just relax, listen to this. Is something delightfully hypnotic about being alone on a beach and just that sound. You could be anywhere in the Caribbean. It's stunning.
This is looking promising. Are you Michelle?
I am indeed.
Oh, excellent.
There we go. One phone.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I've got a bit of a charge. It was on low charge, so I charged it up a wee bit for you.
That's extremely kind. I was looking out for the post van, but of course you haven't got a red post van.
Not yet. I'm going to pick it up at the post office.
Oh, you're away?
Yeah.
Oh, this is you on the way to work?
On the way to work, yeah.
Blimey. We tried phoning the phone last night just to see if anybody had picked it up, and then because of that, Magnus was able to swipe it and phone straight back. Is this a common occurrence?
Not really, no. Usually when they hit the ground, they're good.
Gone.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome.
Very, very kind. Thank you. Cheers then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's
So you got your phone back?
Incredibly, yes, I did. Michelle dropped it off to me, the post lady, and Magnus had found it on the causeway. The screen is smashed, but it's still perfectly functional. He contacted his pal Michelle, who's the post lady. She brought it, the 30 miles, to me, and not only that, she charged it up for me. She said it was getting a bit flat. I mean, how kind is that?
We should have an award service. The best postman and best postwoman.
Yeah.
My postie's fantastic as well, if you're listening. I'm quite excited about this. It's very, very blowy, but we're on a unique part of the North Coast.
I know you've been here before.
Yeah,
I never
40 years ago.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's changed much. It's been here an awful long time. And this has got to be one of the highlights.
It's just a really narrow cleft, a kind of mini fjord. We're about, I don't know, 100 feet down.
Yeah.
Very, very narrow, beautiful green water. And on our right, we have this.
We've got the cave.
It's one heck of a cave.
This is the Smoo Cave, and we're reading the board on the way down. And Smoo is apparently from a Norse word meaning cave.
So
we're now
cave.
Going into the cave.
And it's one of the biggest cave entrances in Scotland.
Yeah.
300 yards off the main road,
You
would never know it was here, and suddenly
there's rock doves flying in and out.
And what I love about this, and this is the joy of radio, you will have noticed, and if you weren't listening carefully, listen now, because we went from a completely windy, open landscape. You're getting a hint of an echo now. You get the sense of being in a cave.
Yeah. And you're passing through all sorts of wild plants here too. I mean, there's celandine, there's sunspurge. Back there was wood avens. The roof of the cave is actually held up by these natural buttresses.
There's a man selling hard hats here, which is a bit worried.
For that. I think we're actually supposed to be meeting Colin Coventry down here. I don't know if that's him.
I think he's Mr. Smoo Cave.
Okay.
A lot of water around as well.
Hello. Looking for Colin.
Hi.
So you run the tours here?
Absolutely, yeah.
What a fantastic place.
Yes, an ancient place. It's Cambrian limestone, 550 million years old, but it's classic Scottish geology here.
If we're not hijacking you, would you be kind enough to give us a tour into the cave?
Absolutely.
So why do you need the hard hat? I know the answer.
Just bump your head. It gets a bit low in there.
Okay,
So this isn't the main event then? There's more?
This is the main chamber. This is a sea cave. But as we go further in, everything in there is made by fresh water.
Okay. So it's kind of dissolved limestone?
Absolutely. Rainwater, it's mild carbonate.
It's my geological fact of the week.
And so that will dissolve limestone.
Yeah. Right, so we're going on a boat?
We take a boat across the waterfall chamber, and then we're going to get out of the boat and walk for about another 100 metres further into the cave.
Exciting.
Yeah. First thing you do is you come across a wooden walkway, and then you walk down here. Oh wow, look at this. This is brilliant.
You can
see
where
a wee flooded grotto.
You can see where Disney got the inspiration from.
Yeah.
And we're going to go down.
Go backwards down a ladder.
Backwards down a ladder.
Into a rubber boat.
Into a rubber boat, how exciting.
And Colin's got a little Hiawatha paddle.
On the side.
Yep.
And if you could sit next to this lady here.
Okay. Big old inflatable boat. Now it's going to tip badly to one side any second now.
Here, just balance it.
Spread out the weight.
That might be a big job.
That's it.
Could you sit a bit more on the side?
Yeah.
It's taking three of us to balance Mark.
Yes. Also, there's a lot of one here. I knew it, but I'm kidding. Effectively, we're in an inner chamber now, which is flooded, and there's a waterfall coming down to the left of us through one of the holes.
It's just this narrow shaft. Straight up to the surface. And this waterfall coming all the way down.
Yeah.
I think we're going to tie up just next to the waterfall.
Now, this is the waterfall chamber.
Yeah.
Now, on the far side of this chamber, you see a huge crack running up the wall that goes right across below us, through a rock bridge up there, and then down the other side of the chamber. That's the fault line. First you'll have rainwater inside a fault line, and rainwater will dissolve limestone. Mild carbonic acid rainwater. Really. And do you see this big overhang above us, about 50 foot above us? That's the phreatic line. That's above the phreatic line, that's the original cave. And below the phreatic line, that's from the meltwater after the ice age. And all the caves in the highlands will be the same shape as this, see? The fault line, the first cave, and then a much bigger meltwater section there. Now, this being Scotland, there's got to be a monster somewhere, eh? We've got the piranha here, you know. Vicious, they are.
What is that, isn't
it? Oh, it's trout.
Oh, no, it's
fine. How did the trout get here? Somebody chucked them in.
Well, they would have been here from right after the Ice Age. And once the ice receded, Scotland was still connected to Europe. Eh? You could have walked from here to Denmark 8,000 years ago. So we were still connected by rivers to Europe. So all the freshwater fish in the highlands, they basically swam here on rivers that connected us with Europe.
You're feeding them. There can't be much natural feed here.
They do very well here. These trout feed off freshwater marine snails, and the bottom here is covered in snails. That's probably why they like a wee bit bread now and again.
The bread hit the water there, and the water started to boil almost immediately. Those fish are trained. Those are performing trout.
Well, they're sick as snail.
They're sick as snail. No, fair enough.
I can go along with that. Slightly surreal, isn't it?
It's incredible that this exists in Scotland, and so few people know about it. Well, what we're passing under now is a natural bridge into another part, but it's all lit up on the inside.
A lot of ropes as well.
Colin's just nipped
he's
out
in the
front
water.
Of the boat. He's in the water. He's only up to his ankles, right enough. But
so how many times a day do you do this?
Well, a busy day will be about 20, 25 tours or something.
So did you just drift into this by accident?
Right, yeah. I used to work here for the Highland Ranger Service. Yeah. And in those days, it was a seasonal job. You weren't really sure if you're going to get the job next year or not, so I decided I'd try being self-employed and do tours here. Now, I thought I might do it for a couple of years. That was 32 years ago. I forgot to leave her. This is the chert. Now, you've seen the sparks coming off of this chert here.
Wow.
Now, this is not flintstone. Flintstone comes from a Carboniferous limestone. That's 200 million years. All the Durness limestone is Cambrian. This is 500 million years. But the first people that came here, they used chert, the same as flint. Eh? Now, we've been up in Orkney, Scarabray. Now, all the stone tools at Scarabray are from the Durness limestone. There's no limestone in Orkney. I think they came from this cave. I think this was a Neolithic chert quarry. This is one of the reasons so many hunter-gatherers lived around here.
So this was a kind of Neolithic B&Q?
Absolutely. Totally. Absolutely. Now you've got to really mind your head here. Yeah. Seriously, you've got chert here. It's really sharp rock. You don't want to bump yourself.
Beginning to get narrower. You've got the water running through. It's about 5-6 feet across.
Yeah, this is the narrowest bit. Let me show you this bit for a wee minute. If you look above us here, you'll see bits of grass and heather stuck in the roof here. That was Hurricane Bertha, 2014, on 10th of August 2014, and the water level was right up to the roof here.
Wow.
Yeah, we take people in here every day, but there's no doubt about it, this is a seriously dangerous place. We have to be very careful here.
Luckily, you're a member of the Mountain Rescue.
Totally. Well,
cave
I'm a
rescue.
Yeah, I'm a member of the Scottish Cave Rescue Team.
Yeah. Goodness me. Wow.
It's like lots of skulls covered in slime.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's exactly what it's like.
Now, this is, in front of us here, there's a thump. Now, there's a lot of water coming up. Eh? Now, this water goes underground 500 metres from here. Now, I know this. I put a dye down a very small sinkhole 500 metres inland from here. The dye came out the sinkhole here, but it also came out of a small sump in the sea cave 100 metres from here. So the dye testing says there's a kilometre of cave somewhere behind this wall.
How long did it take?
Well, it only took a short while, a few minutes, but it's still coming out. And what we believe is that there's a huge volume of water here. Now, I've got a UV light here. And you'll see a slight tinge to this, a slight greenish tinge to the water there. Now, this dye, I put that dye in over 10 days ago, and it's still coming out. It's very much diluted. It was a really bright green when I first put it in, but it's still coming out. So what that says is there's a huge volume of water somewhere behind there, and perhaps we might even find another underground lake. Now, we've tried diving here, but we had a problem diving here with all the mud from the peat. See, once you stir up all the mud from peat, you've no visibility, and we've never managed to find a way through the sump.
Can I just say, sorry, you have tried diving here?
I first tried to dive this 25 years ago. It was the single most terrifying experience of my life.
You seem like such a sensible person. It's such a stupid thing to do.
Well, I know it does, but having said that, we found a lot of caves in the Highlands by diving these sumps. They're worth having a go. This one didn't.
Somewhere down there might be another massive cave.
Oh, totally. What I believe is, but in Neolithic time, I believe hunter-gatherers were walking in here 10 metres below where we're standing, and that this, what is now a sump, is actually the entrance to a very large cave. This sump that looks rather scary and small just now is actually probably up to 8 metres high cave and 3 or 4 metres wide.
So there could be anything down there. There could be tools, artefacts.
Totally. But what we're finding here, we've had some charcoal is slowly coming out. Now, I first noticed this charcoal only about 3 years ago, and it's the first thing you notice when you go into caves. If there's charcoal, that means people. The only reason for charcoal inside caves is people. Now, we had the charcoal analysed, and some of the charcoal turned out to be hazelnut shells. That's people.
People talk about going into outer space and things like that, but I mean, effectively you're going into inner space. This is a form of exploration which is literally under your feet and mostly ignored.
Oh, totally. Yeah, you don't have to go to darkest Africa to find unexplored places. I live pretty much right above us here. So,
can I be a real pain? There's other people on this tour, but one of the joys of radio is you very rarely get total silence, and we're not going to get total silence just now, but I'd quite like just to have 15 seconds.
Absolutely.
Just enjoy the moment. So this is the silence of Smoo Cave.
I actually thoroughly enjoyed that. I had no idea it was going to be as good as that.
Fascinating place. And the trout were a bit of a new one for me as well.
Quite.
Somebody must have put them in there, but it'd be interesting genetic study.
Yeah. Anyway, we're coming away from Smoo Cave and we're heading towards another potential highlight on this trip, which is we're going to try and get across to Handa Island, which is beautiful. It's a bird sanctuary. The thing is, it's actually blowing quite strongly today, so we won't know until we get there whether the ferryman's actually working or not. So
yeah, because there's nothing between us and North America. It's really wild. The sea's very, very choppy. So a boat trip might be off.
Maybe. It's still, I mean, it's a fantastic road, this, because, again, the scenery has changed. We've gone from really quite tall mountains, you know, very rocky, very, very, very hard landscape, to something that's a bit lower, no less dramatic, but there's a lot of green in this too.
And the road has gone from single track, which is a big attraction for many, but we certainly hit the high season camper van route at one point.
Yeah, and they were all heading in the opposite direction, but everybody seemed to behave themselves, so that was okay.
Yep, so we're on a twin track road, beautiful rolling countryside. We're back in the land of gorse again. painfully yellow, and lots of wee lochans as well.
We're in luck. The sun is shining. It's still very breezy, but the ferry is running, and Roger's going to take us across. So
I think it's going to get loud as well.
Yeah, I suspect so, but worth it. I'm quite excited about this.
Excited everything.
Yeah, true, actually. Big kids on us.
Yeah, copy, Roger, go ahead.
Yeah, Tom, that's me on my way across. I'll be with you shortly.
Is
Tom the guy we're going to see, is it?
Tom's the ranger. Yeah, he was the ranger last year and he's doing another year this year.
Right, so he's been bad, has he? So how windy does it have to get before you don't run?
It really depends the direction of the wind. The southwest's the worst. It comes down the sound and you get the wind over the tide. That makes a bit problematic. The east wind isn't a problem, it's just coming off the land and it's small water really, so that's the main concern, is trying to land people on the beaches if there's motion to keep the boat still. It's got to be safe for them getting on and off. So really the crossing isn't the worst, it's being able to land safely, that's the most important side of it.
We're doing the North Coast 500, mm-hmm. You know, obviously it's getting more and more and more popular. Are you noticing a difference in your business?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We get a lot of people anyway who are dedicated bird watchers, but there's a lot of people now who are just coming because they're on the North Coast 500 and it's a nice place to go and have a few hours break. So, yeah, we are seeing an increase in people, yeah.
Maybe a bit splashy here, guys, just a wee.
Coming up to the beach now.
Beautiful wee beach.
It's a wee sheltered bay. The wind is on the other side of the island from this bay. So the water itself is a sort of light jade green colour.
You
golden sands. And there's
off,
already,
now,
I don't know, half a dozen people on the beach.
Yeah, it's real electric green, isn't it? It's great.
I know this is becoming repetitive, and I'm, again, no apologies. An idyllic location between two sets of cliffs, Golden Sands, and Tom Ovenden, who's a ranger for the Scottish Wildlife Trust. How long are you stationed on hand at Island 4 at a time?
So it's 6 months of the year. So the island's open from sort of the 1st of April till early September, depending on weather conditions. But yep, so we leave the island occasionally to get food, but 6 months season.
So is it mainly birds that the reserve is for?
Yep, so we're sort of an internationally important breeding seabird colony. So we're awarded the designations of SSSI, which is a site of special scientific interest, and an SPA, so we're a special protected area as well. And probably the biggest guillemot breeding colony in the UK still, so about 54,000 of those, so just a couple.
Describe the island to me. I mean, just give me a rough dimensions.
So it's about 360 hectares. It's about a square mile. We've got the highest point of the island is the big dramatic sea cliffs at one end, and they're about 123 metres high, and it comes all the way down obviously to sea level here where we are at the moment on these gorgeous sandy beaches.
Where are you going to take us?
Well, we're going to go up to the Great Wall and check out the stack and see if we can spot a few puffins along the way.
Sounds good to me.
So we're going to see them, or are they just going to be further down the stack?
Well, hopefully you'll see them. I can't promise anything. Wildlife being as fickle as it is.
We're after concrete promises.
No, we're not having
this contractual bargains.
Yeah, yeah. Promise is a promise.
You climb up onto this kind of the shoulder of the island, and there's this boardwalk, but it gives you much better views right across this range of hills. Talk us through.
So we're just up here on the Lichen Heath, as you say, on the boardwalk, and we've got Ben Stack over there far to the right that we couldn't quite see earlier, and then we've got Solvan, and I think that's Foynaven, and then as we move further left, we've got Ben Stack, and then Arkell just to the left-hand side there, just poking out around the side.
Yeah. It is an extraordinary landscape, you know, because essentially it's sandstone and Lewisian gneiss and everything else. It's just it's a bit like Arizona. You have these things just sticking up out of the ground.
Yes, I mean, some of the rocks on the mainland we can see there between Scoury and Tarbert, they're some of the oldest rocks in the world. I believe they're about 4 billion years old.
A fair pile of ruined cottages. Presumably this was pretty heavily populated at one time.
Well, it was around 60-odd people, I think, is more, and they sort of disappeared around about the middle of the 1800s. There was a potato famine, and it did sort of coincide with the clearances, and I think all the population went to Canada. But the island used to have a queen, and I think it was the oldest widow on the island. And
the Queen of Handa,
so the story goes.
Yeah.
And the people used to bring, back in the 1700s, I believe, when there was still wolf on the mainland, used to bring their dead and bury them on Handa so that the wolves didn't dig the corpses up.
Somewhere there's a big cemetery.
Aye, well, we passed a medieval graveyard just down in between the two beaches just down there, the slightly roped off section. There has been an archaeology report done on the island, but I don't know a great deal about it, I'm afraid.
Okay, so we are heading up to the Great Stack or the Great Wall.
The Great Stack comes first,
etc. So what is that point highest there?
It is indeed, yeah, that's the trig point on the top of the island, so that's just off the main path, so you won't sort of be able to get right up to that point.
Yeah.
We do ask people to stick to the main path, because it's quite fragile habitat around here, and the birds are sort of starting to settle down for the breeding season.
You can't see any killer whales yet.
Last year, actually. So 2 days last year, we had a pod of orca came down. Mm-hmm. And as far as I'm aware, certainly not a marine mammal ecologist, but they we're believed to be the Icelandic pod, because I think the reasonably resident pod of orca up here are past breeding age. They're one of the only other species to go through a menopause. This pod that we had here actually had some young with them, so it was amazing. I was actually stood here with a pair of German visitors looking out there across to the old man of store, and just happened to have a scope with me at the time, and seeing a male, and they must have had a metre and a half dorsal fin on him. It was beautiful, amazing. 2 days they hung around for.
You ever seen an orca?
Never, but I'm not bitter. You've got quite a lot of nice interaction here with the skua.
Skua, you can
just coming around the back. There's one in the nest right in front of us.
Yes, and that's a great skua just there as well, yeah.
So you've got a big population?
Yeah, we do have quite a large population, actually. So we didn't actually do the monitoring of the Great Skua or the Arctic Skua last year. But the last sort of count that we did was in 2015, and there were 260 Great Skua territories, and there were 16 Arctic Skua territories, so in 2015.
They are perfectly camouflaged.
Yeah.
It keeps good spotting, actually.
It keeps on disappearing. I mean, I can't even see it. You just see the slight movement now.
Yeah.
The Arctic skua have a wonderful habit of setting their nests up right next to the boardwalk. So
give it
a month or so and they're starting to really bed down. They get extremely territorial, and sometimes you might have to walk with your hand in the air because they will come down and dive bomb you.
I've still got scars on the back of my bald head from St Kilda.
Yeah, because the great skua make a lot of fuss and they will come at you, but in my experience, they will rarely hit you. The Arctic skuas mean it.
Yeah, they really do.
They like the taste of blood.
Yeah, you sometimes have turned around and found one uncomfortably close to my face. So yeah.
We must be getting quite close to the cliff edge a bit now, but Tom, I shouted you back here because what's that? It looks like an overgrown thermos flask in black with the numbers 99 in blue on it.
So that's one of our homemade rat monitoring tunnels. So some of the fish farm tubing washes up on the beach quite often, so we try and reuse stuff where and when we can. And unfortunately, we had rats on the island. They were eradicated in the past, but they've recolonised. So unfortunately, we do have brown rat back on the island.
When did that happen?
It was around about 2013, I believe.
They came back on again?
Yeah, they did, yeah. So a brown rat can swim up to a mile, to my knowledge, and our closest point to shore is 400 metres here. So what we're doing now is sort of monitoring, because obviously they're a big problem for ground nesting birds. There's 99 of them. That's 99 of 99. And they're sort of distributed around the island. So once a month, we go around and check, and we make homemade wax tube blocks with them. So there's chocolate powder mixed with wax, and then we can sort of check to see if the teeth marks and the gnaw marks are representative of a rat being present.
So you've got rats here. What are you going to do about it?
So we've currently got a monitoring program in place just to sort of ascertain where they are around the island and how they're spreading, and we've had a feasibility study done, and we'll sort of decide on an appropriate course of action in due course.
So we're just approaching the cliffs here for the first time now, and you can see the fulmars flying around close to us.
This is spectacular. We're about 100 metres above the sea. There are rocks sticking out of the water. The clarity of the water is just incredible. It's quite dark, dark blue. You can see golden sands to our north, essentially the beaches up there, but then dark, dark hills behind that. Really dramatic. And these red cliffs. There are a few birds about, but this is as nothing in comparison to peak season.
No, well, I mean, it's not a particularly busy section of the cliff because of the ledges are formed just there. As we get a little bit further around and you come to the Great Stack, it'll just be incredible, the amount of guillemots and razorbills and kittiwake that you'll see nesting on the Great Stack.
You can. Once you get your eye in, you suddenly see the rows of the guillemots just clinging to that cliff edge.
Oh, that's right. They're quite nest loyal as well, so they'll site loyal. They'll come back to the same tiny wee section of a ledge every year to breed.
Why don't they fall off when they fall asleep?
Oh, it's a good question. I don't know if I know the answer to that one. Great balance.
Would you fall asleep there?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Just listen to that skylark there.
It's fantastic. And then we've got about 1,000 miles of open sea in front of us. Beautiful.
And just over this rise, you've probably seen it before me.
I haven't.
Well, you're about 2 feet tall.
No, I know. But look at that. Holy moly. I see what you mean, Tom.
Just gets better and better, eh?
Sure does.
So what we're looking at here just on this face of the cliff is predominantly guillemots. They're all the black and white birds that you can see on the ledges just there. And you might be able to just make out some sort of grey, fair-faced gulls just sort of on the ledges there. So they're kittiwake. You see a couple coming into land. So they build nests every year, whereas the guillemots are, they're a bit lazier. They just pop an egg on the ledge. The guillemots have amazing eggs, actually. They're slightly different to a normal egg, and they taper a lot more into a sort of almost like a cone. Mm-hmm. So they can sort of roll around on a ledge a lot better than a normal egg would.
Oh. Any estimates on numbers?
On this cliff face we're just looking at here?
Well, here's an interesting experiment.
Yeah.
You'll know how many, possibly. What have you seen?
I don't know. 15,000.
I'm seeing 3,200.
I think you'll be a little bit closer. On that face there, it'd be 4,000 to 5,000 possibly on there. Mm-hmm. So we have a 54,000 around the whole island, but we do that monitoring from the boat and from the land, so some sections of the cliffs that you can't see. Sorry, you win.
How do you count them? Do you just kind of...
One, two, three.
Oh, you joke, but that's it. Yeah, so through binoculars, one by one, and through scopes, absolutely right, yeah. Oh, and then on the boat, that gets a little bit harder with the motion of the waves and looking through a set of binoculars at very fine cliff ledges. Yeah. But you do the best you can.
This is all very well, but they're not puffins.
Oh, well, I can see a couple just over there. I brought a pair of binoculars for you.
Good. Oh, cool. Okay, where's the puffins then?
All right, so they're quite far just on the top of the stack there. So if you follow...
I see them.
So there's also some razorbills just sitting along the top edge just there as well. And you can see the great black-backed gull. I don't know if you can just see the big gull just sit on top of there.
Just waiting, is it?
Well, I always liken it to nesting in a larder.
They must be very well-fed gulls.
They are indeed, yeah. They occasionally cause a bit of a ruckus by eating some of the puffins, and it's obviously in plain view, but it's the way the cookie crumbles.
So what happens come fledging time?
Oh, it's a pretty spectacular sight, to be honest. So all of the wee guillemot chicks are sat on the ledges, and... nice warm summer evening, you'll come up and they'll just be sort of teetering on the edge, ready to go, and sometimes Dad gives them a little bit of encouragement and they just jump into the sea, and then Dad stays with them for a couple of weeks in the ocean just sort of until they leave proper, so to speak. Most of them survive, I'd say, survive the drop.
If not the skuas.
Well, yeah, that's... And the ravens come past and take the eggs, which is a pretty spectacular sight if you ever see it, so...
Well, there's a raven just... went round the side of that cliff just now. I don't know if he's coming back or not.
It'd be great if we could see that. The first guillemot egg was spotted the other day as well, which is really nice, so that's kind of a defining moment in the season.
Tell us what happened just there.
Oh, so we were just sitting here listening to the cliffs, and a raven just came past with an egg in its beak, and actually the first time I've ever seen it. Like, I've seen pictures of it, so that's a pretty special moment for me too. It's quite unusual to see it, but it does happen quite frequently.
So is it a technique that they use?
I'd have to say I don't know, to be honest. I think it must be pretty skillful to get into a ledge, grab it in your beak and fly off again. But they're quite good at it, from my understanding. Clever birds.
I caught it out the corner of my eye. I didn't see the egg in its mouth, but I did see... Did you?
I saw the egg. It was certainly sort of a lump of white in its beak.
Yeah. But what I did see was that a couple of the other birds thought about mobbing it, but they're actually very, very disinclined to really engage with the bird. They kind of shy off.
Well, there's also that selfish thing as well of if I go and mob it, and I have seen them doing it in pairs, my nest's left exposed. Mm-hmm. So there's that selfish gene kicks in as well, tough luck.
Yeah.
But if it got one, it'll be back again. Mm. It'll maybe stay for a while. Well, Jimmy, what's worse than sitting on a cliff top at the end of the world watching a cliff full of wildlife?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a raven, look.
There's a raven.
Perfect. It's got something in its beak, something white.
Yeah, it's got another egg.
Now a serial offender.
Definitely got an egg, yeah.
There's a couple of the birds chasing after it, hopefully, but...
That's so cool.
So cool.
So, he's going to be back.
He'll probably be back, or she. Yeah.
So they have a nest along there?
Yeah, I've never seen the nest, to be honest. To be honest, I'm not entirely sure where they nest. It's not a bird I'm particularly familiar with.
Well, he's going right up. Oh, he's going round the corner of the cliff.
Probably to get it away from anybody that wants to steal it off him.
Yeah. I reckon he'll be back. There's one just come in there. See in the
right.
Top of that?
The top of, you see it? The top of the rocks there.
It's just, he's landed.
It's landing, it's kind of dropping down and amongst the rocks.
What's amazing me? It's just they're kind of face to face.
Yeah.
The birds aren't reacting. He's got that wee cleft.
No,
disappeared.
It's kind of disappeared. And that's it coming out loud. Look. See, it's actually got the egg in its mouth.
Yeah, that's a razorbill egg for sure.
How do you know that? It's very, very white.
A razorbill egg, yeah. And see, there's a group of razorbills just hanging around there. He's just popped in and then probably picked it right from underneath him.
I mean, we've been here, what, half an hour, 40 minutes, something like that. That's four or five we've seen.
Would they have an impact on the population?
Undoubtedly have an impact, but I mean...
He's back again. Look. Well, let's just see if it does it the same again.
Can I borrow the bins again?
One of the kittiwakes is having a go at it.
Aye.
But it's almost like he's really got the hang of it now.
Yeah. He's just cruising for a bruising now. See what he does again this time. Because it seemed to be that he came over the top of the stack and dropped down.
Here we go.
Here it goes.
Same story.
Exactly the same thing. It's landed in amongst... No, it's gone off again.
Real drama, live, on Hander.
Never seen that before. Have you seen it before?
I've never seen that before, no. Yeah. No, never in person. I've been unfortunate enough to be shown 1,001 pictures of other people seeing it.
Anything else you want us to lay on for?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I was hoping the orca would swim past and just give us that crowning moment for you, but, you know.
Throw a seal out the water, you know, that kind of thing. The motto of this programme is, you should have been here yesterday.
You're listening to Outdoors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith, and we are on the North Coast 500.
Yeah, don't phone us, because we're obviously on the road, but you can email the programme. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, or you can write to us, old-fashioned mail.
Yep, Outofdoors, BBC Radio Scotland, Beechgrove Terrace, Aberdeen, AB15, 5ZT. Send us a letter, or better still, post us some batteries.
We stopped off in Scowry now,
because we thought we'd just top up the car with juice.
We're not going to be stopping in Scowry for very long.
Oh.
The charging machine, it's not even... I've had problems with the card not working.
Uh-huh.
But
is
this
dead?
Is dead. It's a dead thing. Actually causes serious problems. How much you got left in the clock?
I'm not terribly certain. I think it's about 90. Maybe 80, 85. I don't know. Hang on a moment. I'll tell you.
86 miles. That's causing us serious problems.
Why?
Because we're at Scowry.
Okay, so the route goes...
We're down there, and we've got to take a loop, the Quinnig Peninsula. That's quite a big loop. We've got enough juice to get straight to Ullapool if we miss that out.
No,
but that's cheating to a certain extent.
Well, say we've got 80, right? From here, from Scowry to Ullapool, is about 40 miles.
Yeah.
They're about in a straight line. I would say that loop around the Quinnig Peninsula is probably no more than about 20, I would say.
Well, more than that.
Well,
you're cutting it pretty fine.
Well, but... You know,
and that range thing's not been very good anyway.
Well, no, not entirely. But I would like to be able to say that I'd done the whole North 500.
We do have a get-out-of-jail card to a certain extent with because it carries a generator, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I haven't seen it. I don't even know.
No, it's built into the car. It's what's known as a range extender. So theoretically, if this dropped down to 5% battery power, this thing kicks off. It doesn't have a petrol engine. What it's got is a petrol generator that powers the battery for an additional, say, 40 miles. So theoretically, we should be okay.
So we'll limp home at 5 miles an hour, do we?
No, you don't. I wish you'd listen. It drops down to 5% and this thing kicks in automatically. It says it's got 43 miles on it. 43 miles.
Okay.
But
we're cutting it fine.
Well, what do you want to do?
No, I think we should do it. Well, what's the point of that? I mean, jeopardy is the spice of life.
Oh, well.
What could possibly go wrong?
I've always wanted to sleep in a ditch. It'll be fine. We've just turned off on this loop with very limited battery power, but that cuckoo's giving it big licks up there.
No point speaking to me, I'm stuffing my face with bread. I don't know what it is about this area. It is rife with cuckoos. Absolutely rife.
I actually saw one like, about 5 minutes ago as he came over the Kalskew Bridge. Yeah. Fantastic looking birds. You very rarely see them.
Well, very hawk-like, you know, but they're sort of...
Hawk meets pigeon.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's that sort of dove grey, almost like a sort of steely blue grey that you actually see just a flash of. Handsome bird, but...
We were talking about changes in landscape earlier on. We sort of suggested we'd left the mountains behind, but we're back in amongst it now.
Well, this is us. We've crossed the Kalskew Bridge, and we've taken a right, and we're just about to start doing this loop, which we may or may not have enough power to do. And I know it sounds terrible like Top Gear, but we genuinely want to be able to do the entire thing. Say we've done the entire thing.
In an electric car.
In an electric car, when the last charging unit we looked at didn't work at all.
Didn't work at all. But you were talking about it as we came over, and it's been a recurring theme. How beautiful it is. Yeah. It is just mind-blowing.
Yeah. Every so often you see a house by the side of the road somewhere that somebody's put up. There's some really, really beautiful modern houses too. You wouldn't think it. Fit really well in the landscape. Very thoughtful. And you just think, oh, I'd like that. I'd like that. I'd like that one too. Mm-hmm. Nice.
And that male calling the female is slightly sinister as well. He mates with that female. She stands on a branch or in this kind of situation in a rock, and she just watches and watches, and then she'll see a ground nesting bird. And the minute the female on the nest leaves, bang, and she goes, lays the egg, and then she heads south again. The males hang around for a bit longer looking for another mate, but it's a great sound. Starting to resent traffic.
Go away, shoot.
Stopped on the road. Well, how best to describe this? You asked us how we were coping with the traffic. Which actually hasn't been too bad today, other than a terrible rash of camper vans first thing in the morning.
Well, that's par for the course, really.
You're local, I take it?
I am, yeah.
We were quite lucky. When we went the camper vans, it was kind of in the north section. But we're on this wee loop, this wee peninsula. And it's a torturous road at the best of times. You don't need to tell you that. It's a bit of a brute of a road, isn't it?
It's a challenge. It's a challenging drive at the best of times, even when you know the road, because you never know what's coming round the corner at you. And people can drive at excessive speeds, because there's obviously no speed restriction on the road. So you can meet motorbikes in the middle of the road, you can meet massive camper vans, you could meet continental visitors who will go to the right into the passing place that you are hoping to go into, to let them pass, and so on. So it can be very difficult, and you can get behind drivers who aren't aware that they could pull into a passing place and let you get past.
Clues in the name. The passing place,
that's right. And I don't think people appreciate how busy the road can be with local people getting to work. Carers, medical folk, just
so
people going down.
How does it affect your day if you're going to look in there or something?
Well, I would just allow myself extra time. You know, I'm not working, so I can easily do that. But for the folk that are working, impacts, I think, on them quite a lot, and people can get quite frustrated about it.
But it's a difficult one, isn't it? It's obviously being a lot of benefit to local shops, the community, but the reality of living with the North Coast 500 is very real for a lot of people.
Well, it is, and that's really never acknowledged.
I saw a thing up in Sky about 6 months ago, and somebody had created almost, it was like a little cartoon booklet of how to use single track roads in passing places. That kind of thing might be quite useful.
That would be useful, yes, it would be, but... Who would enforce that?
You could have a community policeman at the end of your road, just pulling folk in. Now, guys, this is how it works. Job creation. Because we also suffer from the overabundance of etiquette. You know, I'll stop, they stop, and flash lights, and you both go, and then you both reverse.
That can happen, yes, it's all part of the challenge.
Yeah, it's the single-track two-step, basically, isn't it?
You could say that, yeah.
Well, listen, thank you very much for stopping to talk to us.
Are you going or are you coming back?
I'm coming back home.
That's a pity, because we've got, I think, 40 miles in our electric car tank to get to Ullapool via Loch Inver. How far is it to Ullapool from here via Loch Inver?
It's more than 40 miles.
I think no, I know, he's exaggerating. I think we've got about 60.
You'll make it then, that'll be all right.
Yeah. Cheers then, bye-bye. That has to be the most switchbacky piece of road anywhere in Scotland.
That's heavy going, that.
That was extraordinary.
I love it, but it's great.
We've stopped at one of the viewpoints. The road's actually widened out a wee bit here. We've stopped one of the viewpoints because we're overlooking what is, well, it's my favourite mountain in Scotland, it's Solvan. It's effectively got a double peak and a saddle, but from here, it just rises. It's like a child's drawing of a mountain. It's extraordinary.
Kind of puts Brazil to shame.
Doesn't it just? Doesn't it just? No, but we're standing on the North Ascent Estate. It was bought by the Ascent Crofters back in the early 1990s.
1993, I think.
Oh, there's another information board behind me. Fine, okay, right.
I'm constantly forgetting how awesome it is.
Yeah.
It's just so rugged, so dramatic.
And coming back to this idea of the North Coast 500, it's great that so many people have been encouraged round a part of Scotland that they would never have dreamed of going otherwise. They are going now. It's just we need to improve the infrastructure, not in a way that damages the experience, but that actually facilitates the lives of ordinary folk that live and work here.
There must be two roads, because there are so many blind summits.
Ooh.
And tight corners, and you're coming up over it, where's the road going? Where's the road going?
What was that one? There was one that said, blind summit. Went, yeah, we've seen blind summit. And we got to the top and went, whoa, where is the road? You know, that's why it was blind. You couldn't see where the road went afterwards.
You add a Ferrari into that mix coming the other way.
And there
is a danger, not criticizing Ferrari drivers, there's a danger, you think, it is a lonely road, there's nothing coming. Yeah. And there's always that danger. But how do you encourage more and more people to come here and make the lives of folk who use the road daily bearable?
But I'll tell you something I have noticed, because I've been coming around here probably for about the last 20 years, maybe a bit longer than that. There are more shops, there are more B&Bs, there are more hotels, there are more, functional things here now than I remember.
One thing that has just impressed the heck out of me on this information board. How many times in Scotland do you pull up at a lay-by in a beautiful spot and it says, no overnight camping, no parking overnight for some strange reason? Yeah. And this one says,
you are welcome to walk here or even stay overnight. Donations to help the Trust are very welcome. Good on you.
Hats off to the Crofters Trust there. That's great. Why can't you sleep in a lay-by? How many miles have we got left in this?
Probably not enough.
It might be enough. Like a car park.
In a lay-by yet. Thank you, the Crofters Trust of Assen.
This is still disconcerting. No noise. It's the way forward.
Oh, yeah. And backwards. It has two gears. We can, some music would be nice just now.
But we can't.
We can't, for the same reason. We can't put the lights on, the heated seats, the heating, or indeed anything else.
We've got 51 miles left in the tank.
Yeah, and that's on Eco Pro. Once we get past Elphin and turn right, I'm just going to stop off at Knockincrag National Nature Reserve. Arranged to meet Sue Agnew, who's the reserve manager there, because I think they've got a candidate there for, if not the most interesting square metre in Scotland, and certainly one of them.
So here we have John Horne and Benjamin Peach, two of the geological people who really are the key part of Knockincrag National Nature Reserve. And they didn't discover it, but there was a theory that there were layers of older rock sitting on top of younger rock, and they were the ones who actually proved that theory. And it was quite a controversial theory at that time from the geologist's point of view. and comparable to Darwin's theory.
I mean, it was an explosion of an idea, really. You've got the two figures standing here, the Victorian gentlemen, the statues. You know, they have the waistcoats and the collars and the ties and the wing collars and things like that, and the mutton chop sideburns and things like that. But this idea basically introduced the idea of plate tectonics, of one plate sliding up over the top of the other one, and it was hugely controversial at the time.
It was, absolutely. And it goes back to England and Scotland actually being separated by a huge ocean called the Iapetus Ocean. And it was those plate tectonics that pushed us all together. Mm-hmm. So we see that here in the cliff above us, the actual thrust, the Moyne Thrust as it's known, where this older layer is sitting on top of the younger layers.
Is that a speaker behind the statue? Does it do something?
It does. You can press a button here they'll talk to us.
Right. Hello, I'm Ben Peach, and this is my friend and colleague John Horn. We work for the Geological Survey of Great Britain.
Ben and I first came to Knockan together in 1883. Over the next 14 years, we studied the rocks and debated with other geologists until we finally worked out what had happened here.
This is certainly a remarkable place. It's where we first realised...
I don't mean to be rude, but let's move on.
They tell the story much better than I do.
I disagree.
So, welcome to the Rock Room. This is our centre. This is where we try and provide a little bit more interpretation of what people can see around them. It's taken us a while to develop this. The site was built in 2001. We've had the National Nature Reserve here since 2004. And it was to try and interpret what we were seeing, in the cliff above us. And the first time round, we I think, did extremely well, but we refreshed this about 3 or 4 years ago, and we've now got what we consider an absolute first-class visitor centre, where anybody can come and they can read and hopefully start to understand a little bit about the scenery that they're seeing around them, as well as the geological discoveries here.
I've been driving up and down past this for 20, 25 years, probably. Are you noticing an increase in footfall with the North Coast 500?
That's quite interesting. We have a people counter, of course, try and work out how many people we have coming to visit these fantastic National Nature Reserves. And interestingly, the numbers haven't gone up over the last few years.
Really?
Now, there could be a number of reasons for that. We are seeing an awful lot more traffic and perhaps more people coming in and using the car park. And we have fantastic facilities here for them to use. Uh-huh. What we really need to encourage is them to get out of their cars and actually walk and explore and come up the steep path, as we're starting to feel, up to see exactly what is here. Our people counter is not at the car park. It's actually once you cross the path and get to the Rock Room.
Okay.
So the numbers, we haven't seen an increase.
That's fascinating.
It is.
I do wonder, actually, because... I am now an admirer of the North Coast 500. I think it's an excellent idea, a good way of getting people into a part of Scotland that they probably wouldn't have visited otherwise. But if you look at what the habit is in America, people drive to things, they get out the car in the car park, they walk about for a while, they get back in the car and off they go. And you think, no, that makes me uneasy.
Well, we'll look at the car park. We're looking back on the car park here. And you can see, as soon as you get to that car park, well, you've got this fantastic vista. So that in itself sells people stopping at the car park.
Yeah.
How do we then get them out and get them moving, get them walking? The path to the Rock Room is an all-ability path. It should be something that all abilities can walk to the Rock Room and experience a little bit more about it. But we do have, I think, it's possibly happening in lots of places, this difficulty to just entice people out a little bit more, explore, see what fantastic... how the views change as you start going up.
There's so much education needed here in terms of use of single track roads, the fact that you are in Scotland and under the 2003 Land Reform Act, you can basically go where you like responsibly. You know, a lot of people just wouldn't know that instinctively.
I think
they wouldn't be comfortable.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think particularly the single track roads is one of the biggest issues. This used to be a single track road that we're looking down onto now. There was an existing wayleave there, and the Rossshire Council bought the wayleave and created the dual track, and then they moved the wayleave up the hill to where we are now, and that's pretty much when we established a visitor centre here. And there was an old AA box. It was either an AA or an RAC, and there was another one up the road. It was the days where you really couldn't travel very far without running out of petrol.
Yes, or the car breaking down.
Yeah,
exactly. It is a fantastic vista, that through. I mean, you're looking basically up a glen towards Stack Polly. And it's just these series of dark, brooding, menacing's the wrong word, but I mean, they've got real presence, shapes on the skyline.
Yes, I think this is something that's fascinating to look down onto, and I'm not a geologist, so I probably don't explain it very well, but you can imagine these valleys and these glens being filled with ice at one point, yeah. And it's that scouring action and it's the eroding action that have created the landscape that we're looking out across at the moment. Now, this all sits in the Northwest Highlands Geopark, which is an accolade, and it's a UNESCO accolade that really, I think, helps describe what we have around us and how important it is geologically. But under all the hills and all the mountains and all the landscape we see, there is geology, it's rocks. That is what's created this.
To be a geopark, you've got to be of global significance, essentially. And, you know, and there is no argument. Nobody in their right minds would contest that this area is a geologist's heaven.
Oh, it's fantastic. And I just wish more people would come out and explore it and actually get out into it. As you say, we have some of the most advanced access legislation in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And it means that you can get out and explore it. You can get out of your car, you can get off your cycle, get off your motorbike and actually move out into this fantastic landscape.
I don't remember this being here the last time I was here. Maybe it was, but it was peeing rain the last time I was here, so I maybe just didn't see it. It's like a sort of Andy Goldsworthy stone ball.
Yes, it is. We have a number of these sculptures around the National Nature Reserve, and it was to add an extra element of interpretation of the landscape around us. Mm-hmm. Because, yes, there's the geology, fantastic botany around us too, but actually then how is it interpreted? And we've got quite a few of the local groups come out and use this area, use the NNR, to do art weeks, art weekends, and create their own interpretation of the landscape.
Yeah. I like these stones too. Well, basically, you're 400 million years ago, Scotland collides with England. 200 million years ago, dinosaurs rule Scotland, that kind of thing.
That's right. If you think of deep time, think of geology as a 24-hour clock. Humans have been here for 1 second.
Yeah.
It's quite incredible to think of it like that.
Yeah. And this is us coming up to the evidence of the Moyne Thrust.
I think this is something that everybody should, certainly if they get out of their cars, come up and have a look at. Because it's so easy to understand and very, very visual. You can see very clearly the two separate layers of rock. So you have the Durness limestone, mm-hmm. which is this yellow, creamy, beautiful, beautiful rock. And then you have the Moyne Thrust above it. And we have these set of hands to indicate that if you have one hand on the top and one hand on the bottom, you are feeling 500 million years of time.
We were talking a few weeks ago in the programme about what is the most fascinating square metre in Scotland, and I suspect it's going to be very contentious, but I would contend this is certainly going to be one of the most fascinating, because literally, I mean, I'm now putting my thumb on the limestone and my little finger on the other rock above it. And that is spanning, my hand is spanning 500 million years, half a billion years.
Yes, yes. It's really, really difficult to get your mind, I think, to understand that. And this is the Moyne Thrust. This is exactly as it would have happened. Yeah. It has pushed this very old metamorphosis rock over on top of this much, much younger Durness limestone. And as you can see, what a fantastic place to actually come and have a look at it and try and understand these huge processes that went on with our Earth's movements.
We've just crested the hill with a certain sense of relief because we can see Ullapool now and we're looking right up the loch. And according to this fabby little electric car, we've still got 16 miles of volts or whatever, I don't know, kilowatt hours, something.
We've got 16 miles of usable electricity.
Yeah.
I was a bit sceptical. Well, I got a little bit hacked off.
You were very sceptical, as a matter of fact.
When that power charging point wasn't on.
No.
It's also possible the power thing in Ullapool won't work.
Well, if it doesn't work, then what we'll do is get the cable out of the car and basically plug it into a power socket.
Yeah, it's okay. If you're staying the night somewhere.
If you stay in the night, that's fine.
But if we'd been out of juice, you would be...
But if we'd been out of juice in Scourie, we'd still be in Scourie. Because effectively it takes about 8 hours to charge this thing using alternate current from a plug point.
But such is the popularity of the North Coast 500, you might not be able to get accommodation.
This is also, to be honest, I just chapped in somebody's door, offered them a fiver and said, can I stick that plug in the socket please and I'll come back for it in the morning.
It's been a fair old trip so far.
It's been a fantastic trip so far.
Just all, I mean, when you started Castle Hill.
Yep, absolutely. You know, with all the sort of, you know, architectural magnificence of that, the Caithness slabs. Then from there we moved across. Well, we've seen all sorts of stuff. Highlights for me were probably Smoo Cave. I thought was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. You know, and that chap Colin just has such a pleasant manner about him. Very informative. You know, obviously knows his stuff backwards. And Handa
that did it for me.
Yeah.
Just, and it's real. We're sitting on Macker, looking across 100 feet to a stack and thousands of birds. It's, the diversity is just incredible.
Absolutely astonishing. And seeing the raven take the eggs as well. And Tom, the guide, had never seen that before either. The ranger had never seen that before either. So he was quite excited. Sadly, that's all we've got time for on this particular chunk of the North Coast 500. Talking of Handa, let's just go out on the sound of Handa again from all of the team at BBC Aberdeen. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.